listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth. Truth.
This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the very cold Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me today on RBN. As you know, their website is republicbroadcasting.org. You may view the guest lineup for this program at spingola.com. Just click on the radio schedule button and select the year, month, and day and see who has been on the program and who will be on the program. Please also visit screeningsandyhook.net for articles regarding Sandy Hook, psych, drugs, and related topics. I've not published much about Sandy Hook lately because I'm writing another book. Anyway, consider subscribing to SpingolaSpeaks.net, where one may listen to the audio files of my programs. And, of course, the audio files are also available at RBN, as well as at Wooly's blog, and that's wooliesblog.blogspot.com. If you appreciate the RBN programming, and I hope that you do, please consider donating to the network. You may do that by calling 800-724-2719 or visit republicbroadcasting.org and click donate, or simply send donations to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Email questions or comments to comment@spingola.email. You may join others in the chat room, which is very friendly, by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by visiting spingola.chatango.com. My guest the very first hour is Donald C. Brockett, B-R-O-C-K-E-T-T. He is the author of The Tyrannical Rule of the U.S. Supreme Court, How the Court Has Violated the Constitution. His website is criticalbookspublications.com. He was born in Chicago, Illinois, we're not going to tell his age, but he moved with his family to Los Angeles. That's a good move. And then to Santa Barbara, California, and finally to Spokane, Washington in 1947. He graduated from Lewis and Clark High School and attended Gonzaga University, where he graduated from law school in 1961. He began his legal career in Spokane County, prosecuting attorney's office. And anyway, we're going to chat with him about his book. He has retired. He practiced for 52 years, and he retired. And anyway, has written a book. Donald, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And I promise I'm not going to tell any lawyer jokes or anything like that.
Oh, that would be good.
Well, your book is fascinating. It's a quick read because it's concise, comprehensive, and you covered what you said you were going to cover. And honestly, the Supreme Court has made some decisions. I mentioned that I'd like to talk about the 14th Amendment, but I think another egregious thing that they did was, of course, the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which is amazing. I mean, it puts everybody...
Yes, what the Supreme Court has done is amazing.
Indeed. So anyway, you're in a good position because of your background to evaluate what they've done. And let's talk about the 14th Amendment. And, well, you know, I also like Chapter 7, the Corruption of the Bill of Rights, which has definitely been corrupted. Where do you want to start? What would you like to talk about?
Well, I think what I'd like to talk about is my concern with people in the country not realizing what's happened to them as a result of U.S. Supreme Court decisions. It's my opinion, and as expressed in the book and as you indicated from reading it, that we don't have a government of checks and balances anymore. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court is our supreme ruler, because they have come down with decisions that have been a controverted decision from the Constitution, misleading, misreading phrases, creating phrases and words where they wanted to affect the decisions. And nobody apparently knows that they can't enforce their own law. And we don't have to follow their law as the supreme law of the land, because that's been specifically defined in Article 6 of the Constitution, which says that the only supreme law of the land is this Constitution, the laws of the United States made by Congress and treaties. It does not mention the Constitution, or the Supreme Court. And the reason I think that's true, and I've thought about this long and hard, and I think we need to start thinking about the Constitution differently. The Constitution is a contract. It was a contract made between the peoples of the states in existence at the time and the federal government that those states were creating. It was a contract that placed limitations on the federal government. In other words, the people living in the states already had their own individual constitutions, which they were governed by, and they wanted to make sure that this new federal government that was being created was limited in its powers so that it could not control the states. The people in the states enjoyed their own individual liberties, and if they couldn't change the law in their own state because they didn't like that law, they could, as the phrase was, quote, vote by their feet, end quote, meaning they could move to another state where the laws were more agreeable to them. Well, it's ironic that today, and most people don't understand this, that's no longer true. If you move from one state to another, you're still governed by the U.S. Supreme Court decision that says, for example, that certain privileges and immunities exist throughout the United States. And that's where the Supreme Court has gone wrong, and why I say they're a tyranny, that we're ruled by an oligarchy of few people, 9 people on the Supreme Court. Some of the Supreme Court judges agree with me, and it was interesting that when I was writing the book, the same-sex marriage case came out, and Justice Roberts, for example, in his dissent, traced the history of marriage in all of civilization, and then said that they were overturning that history by their decision, and he said famously, quote, "Who do we think we are?"
Exactly. Wow.
And that's what I say in the book. Who do they think they are? There are only 9 lawyers. By the way, that was another diss, so to speak, by one of the Supreme Court judges, because Justice Scalia, who unfortunately now has passed away, said, "We're now ruled by 9 lawyers on the Supreme Court." Well, most people don't understand the significance of him saying it that way. When a judge refers to another judge as a lawyer, he's bringing him down a notch, in effect, by not referring him to him as a fellow judge. So I thought that was quite a statement by Justice Scalia in vehemently dissenting to what the majority decided, which was a new right we have now, and that is, quote, the right to dignity, end quote. Justice Thomas, I think, said it best, because he said, "The government doesn't give you dignity, nor does it take dignity away from you. You have dignity within yourself as a human being." Now, I think you asked me about the 14th Amendment, so I probably should get to that particular issue.
Let me just ask you, going back to the 13th Amendment, didn't the original 13th Amendment say that lawyers or attorneys should not be a part of the government?
Well, it didn't say it that specifically. I've read that that specific argument, and as I recall, what it was, it said that there should not be anybody in the Congress of the United States or in the federal government who had some kind of a title associated with their name.
Right.
And because lawyers are sometimes referred to as the honorable, for example, I might be referred to as the Honorable Donald C. Brockett, which I would object to because I think, and rightfully so, there's nothing about become a lawyer that made me honorable. It may be that I have a different education, but my son is an engineer. Is he to be entitled something different than honorable because he's an engineer and not a lawyer? So I think that's basically the argument about that original 13th Amendment. I'm not sure it's that clear that they meant to preclude lawyers. Here's the problem I see with that. A lot of people object to lawyers being in the legislatures, and I think that's a good objection, but for the fact that sometimes the lawyers need to be there to educate the non-lawyer on what the result might be from what we call the unintended consequences of an act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oftentimes somebody says, well, I think it would be a good idea if we pass a law that says this. And by the way, that leads in perfectly to the 14th Amendment you wanted to discuss.
Right.
I think the 14th Amendment, and I think you can specifically point this out in an argument that's in the book, was meant only to affect the African Americans who were being freed after the Civil War.
Right.
In other words, they did not have the same privileges and immunities that other citizens of the states who were white did have. They did not have the due process rights that other white citizens had if process was brought against them, for example. They didn't have the equal protection that the other white citizens had, and that's clearly pointed out. And the reason I say that is that it was specifically limited to them and shouldn't have been carried on by the Supreme Court to the rest of us thereafter, is that the same language appears in Article 4, Section 2, which says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. That meant, for example, that now we have 13 states, or at that time they had 13 states, and now that we're forming this constitution, if you're a state citizen of Illinois, you should be entitled to go to Ohio and have the same privileges and immunities of an Ohio citizen. And in fact, what proves that is Section 1 of Article 4, which is called the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the Constitution, meaning that if an act took place in one state, the other state had to give it full faith and credit and could not just not pay any attention to it, for example. So it was to allow the commerce between the states, to allow the people to travel between the states without having to pay a duty when they entered each state, as, for example, they had to do in Europe ages ago before they established, especially the European Union, which they now may be disbanding. So, again, my argument is all of those clauses of the 14th Amendment, and you can see that from some of the arguments of the people during that time, were not meant to be incorporated, quote-unquote, as the U.S. Supreme Court has done, bringing all of the Bill of Rights, first eight amendments of the Bill of Rights, to bear against all of the states and against all of the municipalities within the states.
Right. And when you think of the things, I mean, every resident is now under federal jurisdiction. And some of the other laws that have been passed, such as the Affordable Care Act, it actually obligates people to, to purchase insurance or to do other things. So the 14th Amendment really, really has made us all, well, equal, but not equal. We're not, we're all slaves, I think.
Well, I think the thing that's most important, not to talk about it in terms of the fact that we're all equal, but that we're all equally bound to the federal government, which was
right.
Never the intention of the people who wrote the Constitution. They meant for us to be bound to our states. And in fact, Article 2 is, Second Amendment, the one that most people argue about, is totally misunderstood by people. The whole reason for the Second Amendment was to make sure that you could defend your state from the federal government.
Right.
There was, you know, history was full of examples, and history today is full of examples of the military of a country taking over the people. And the Americans did not want that to happen here. They wanted us to have the right to have a militia within the state, to be able to bear arms so that we could form the militia at any time we wanted to. In fact, there's a clause within the Constitution that says that we're entitled to defend ourselves from foreign invasion if it's necessary. Well, how in heaven's name would we do that if we don't have any weapons?
Right.
So, you know, people need to pay attention to it. The other thing I think that's critical here, talking again about the Constitution being a contract, my proposition in my book is that these changes, and I'm not saying these changes shouldn't have come about, that, for example, allow the appointment of an attorney to defend you if you don't have the money to defend yourself, but it should have been done through the amendment of the Constitution under Article 5, not through the Supreme Court dictating everything that had to be done in a particular way. Or, for example, under the Fifth Amendment, that the Miranda warnings should be given to everyone. That wasn't something that was created in the Constitution. It's something the Supreme Court made up because they thought it would protect people better. Well, it may have protected the defendant or the suspect better, but it didn't protect the rest of us better, did it?
Right.
It certainly served that purpose. And here's the other thing about it being a contract. I learned in contract law in law school that you can amend a contract, but it can only be amended by the parties to the contract.
Right.
If you have a contract, for example, of employment, that says that you're to be paid a certain wage, how would you like it if the person sitting next to you could go into your boss and say, I think I want that contract amended with my friend Charlie who sits next to me because he doesn't work as hard as I do. So, boss, why don't you amend it yourself? Well, that can't happen because the contract is between the boss and Charlie, not between you who wants to amend it. Now, the critical thing here, which people don't, I think about, is the Supreme Court was not a party to the contract.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, the Supreme Court was created by the contract. So how can it amend the Constitution by its decisions and do an end run around Article 5, which requires its amendment? Has anybody raised that question? Not that
I
know of.
You just did. All righty, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest the first hour is Donald C. Brockett. He is the author of The Tyrannical Rule of the U.S. Supreme Court, How the Court Has Violated the Constitution, and that book is available at his website, which is criticalbookspublications.com or available at Amazon, and I recommend that people purchase this book. Now, Donald, you were talking about the Supreme Court and that they're not a party to that contract, and yet here they are, instead of abiding by the Constitution, they're actually creating new laws which are, well, tyrannical. And the function of Congress is to create law, right?
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, they are the most important part of government, as shown clearly by the fact that when the Constitution was written, they were Article 1. Article 3 is the court. So Article 1 is the legislative branch or Congress. Article 2 is the president who is supposed to carry out the law. And, of course, that's another subject. He's not supposed to be making law or the person who's the president. And then the court, which is simply supposed to interpret the law, meaning the law written by Congress. What the Supreme Court did early on in the early case that Justice Marshall wrote, which established what's called judicial review, was to say to the United States, well, we are the Supreme Court and we are entitled to interpret the Constitution also. The Constitution doesn't say that, so they just gave themselves the power to do it.
Holy cow.
The thing that's interesting about that case, if you read it, and I try to point this out in the book, is that that case contained all of that language by Justice Marshall as what's called dicta, D-I-C-T-A, which is a Latin word meaning it has nothing to do with what's being decided. I call it the meanderings or the wanderings of the judge. People who like to write and see what their writing looks like, I guess.
Right.
Because that case was decided on the basis that the court had no jurisdiction over the matter and had to stop deciding the case. So how did any other part of the case get accepted as authority for anything? Well, it did because the court said, wow, this is great. We can give ourselves the authority to do this and nobody's going to question it. What I think is interesting about this whole structure of checks and balances is that we've lost the idea that if you stray from what your purpose was as set out in the contract, there should be a check and balance. And there is a check and balance on the Supreme Court. The first one, as suggested by the writers of the Constitution, is impeachment. Now, some people think that judges on the Supreme Court are appointed for life. That's not true. They are appointed as long as they act in good behavior. Well, is it that good behavior to avoid the amendment of the Constitution and instead make up phrases and words to come up to the conclusion you want to come to? So Congress obviously could impeach them for doing that, if they had the backbone to do it. And they could threaten it, certainly, and they could make the Supreme Court stand up and take notice to the fact that it can be checked and balanced. The second way it can be checked and balanced is that they have no enforcement arm. We remember that in 1954, when African American children were being kept out of certain schools, there was a case called Brown versus Board of Education, and federal marshals had to be sent in to allow the children to go to school, because they are the enforcement arm, aren't they, of
right.
the federal government.
Right.
Well, guess what? Who are they under? They're under the president, the executive branch, not the legislative branch, not the judicial branch, the three branches of government. So we had a president once who refused to enforce the determination of the United States Supreme Court. And he said, Justice Marshall has come down with his decision, now let him enforce it. And he didn't come forward with any United States Marshals. So those are the checks and balances that are built into the system that nobody seems to recognize or wants to use.
I think that people just assume things and that are not true and really don't bother to educate themselves with books like yours or even read the Constitution to figure out what is going on. But the Supreme Court, the egregious laws that they've passed, I think Roe versus Wade and I mean, think of the ramifications of that. 50 million people are dead. All righty. We're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. All righty. This is Deanna, and our guest this first hour is Donald C. Brockett. He's the author of The Tyrannical Rule of the U.S. Supreme Court, How the Court Has Violated the Constitution. His website is criticalbookspublications.com. And just before we went to the break, I mentioned Roe versus Wade, which has cost the lives of a lot of people.
Yes, it sure has. And created a right to privacy, which the court dreamed up as a phrase. That phrase does not appear in the Constitution of the United States. And what most people don't know is where that phrase came from. It actually came from a case that had to do with whether or not a married couple was allowed to use a prophylactic device during sex in their own bedroom, because a state had prosecuted a couple for doing that, and that case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they famously said that the government does not have any business in somebody's bedroom, that people have a, quote, right to privacy, end quote. Later on, because what the Supreme Court follows is what's called stare decisis, picking up phrases and words from previous opinions and applying them, allegedly in cases that are the same on all fours, although most of them are not the same on all fours, but they liked the phrase, so they decided to extend the constitutional phrase to something else. And in Roe versus Wade, they extended it to the right of a woman to make a determination as to whether or not she would continue with the child that was within her. And that right to privacy then became something the court talked about in the Roe versus Wade. What amazes me about the Roe versus Wade case was that the court clearly said in that case that it would apply the decision between the woman and her doctor during the first trimester of the pregnancy. And for some reason now, that's extended to what's called partial birth abortions, where the child is partially born and then killed. And I've not quite understood how anybody can justify that on the basis of Roe versus Wade, or on the basis of any morality at all.
Exactly. How did that get translated into what is really infanticide of several million children? I mean, it's just amazing to me, and it should be amazing to everybody. But yet it occurred in 1973, and I don't think it's ever going to be overturned. I don't think that a lot of things that the Supreme Court has decided are ever going to be overturned, because people have accepted it rather than questioned it. And if you accept something, then your acceptance kind of makes it, the law. Correct or no?
Well, if you accept it as the law, that's certainly true. And that's, you know, the people have to do something about it, as I suggested, in ways that they could in terms of the checks and balances. I have to say, in connection with that, that there was a billboard here in Spokane that was put up and then quickly taken down, and I'm not sure who exercised the authority to take it down, but it showed a mother with a holding a small baby in its arms, and on the billboard it said, "Who would have ever thought that the most dangerous being to a child would be its mother?"
Wow. That's provocative.
Pretty powerful.
Yes.
Pretty powerful, yes. But as I say, it was quickly taken down, and I'm sure it was taken down because people were just ashamed of the fact that they had accepted this, and that billboard so clearly pointed it out that people didn't want it there to see it as a reminder.
Or was it the powers that be, the people to promote abortion, did they have something to do with it being taken down?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, we have a country today that's actually ruled by the minorities,
right,
not the majority. We used to talk about the silent majority, and I used to kiddingly say in speeches that I gave that we politicians were not sure that there was a silent majority anymore because they were so damn silent.
Right. How true. How true.
I mean, people are fairly satisfied with sitting on their couches watching the reruns of television shows instead of getting off of the couch, marching down to their local city council or their state legislature, and having the laws reflect what their ideas are and how they think the government should exist.
Sure.
And people want the government to stay out of their way so that they can do things the way they should, especially in economics.
Right. And it's interesting. I think most of us just feel, oh, somebody else will take care of it. But that's just not the case. If we don't take a stand and say something about what is going on, then we're culpable for what happens to us.
Well, certainly we are, and the thing that's interesting about that is, if you think about it, and of course most people today don't want to put too much thought into anything, if you think about it, if our founders had felt that way, we would be English today.
Right.
We would not have had a revolution. We would not have a constitution that guarantees the freedoms that we have. We would not have a check and balance system, which, you know, what people forget, and I guess, you know, this isn't taught in history and civics classes anymore in school, and it's our fault because we don't demand that it be taught, is that this form of government that we have in the United States of America was an attempt by the people at that time to have something different than what existed in society and in civilization up to that point in time. Every other form of government in the history of mankind up to that point in time had owed its allegiance to either a warlord or a king or a queen.
Right.
And the United States of America decided to try something different, where the people were actually in control of the government. And you know, Deanna, what I think is interesting is I think what people have done is given up. They've said, well, I can't really make a difference. Well, that's not the way you live the rest of your life. You think you can make a difference in connection with your family and your neighborhood and your local community. So why don't you think you can make a difference at the national level? We have now, in terms of the election of a totally different person for president. So I guess we have made a difference.
And I'm not so sure that was, I don't know, we didn't have much of a choice.
We don't know, but at least it's going to be something different.
It's sure going to be something different, all right. That's for sure.
It's not going to be what we had all along that we didn't feel we could influence at all. And we just have to get busy and defeat the tyranny.
Sure.
Well, the Supreme Court, it has a job to do, and we know what its job is, and if it doesn't know what it is, then we'll tell it. It's just supposed to interpret the law and not free phrases and words that they decide to dream up to affect our lives. And then not only do they affect the lives of the people who are before the court in that particular case, but they decide to affect the lives of everyone in the United States.
Right.
That's where it's totally wrong.
So how would the average person, what would the average person have to do in order to change what is going on with the Supreme Court or in the Supreme Court? Who would they write? What would they do?
Well, as you know, as you I'm sure saw in my last chapter of the book, that, by the way, was brought about by the suggestion of a friend of mine who said, okay, you've done a good job describing the problem. Now, what are you going to describe as the solution?
Right. And how so can we make it happen?
I came up with a few ideas in terms of changes that could be made. But I suggested that all I'm trying to do is start a discussion. I'm not trying to say those are the ways that we should do it. I just think we should sit down and start a discussion. But where it has to start, obviously, is with Congress. Each one of us elect representatives and senators. We have to flood them with mail, with email. We have to go to Washington and march on Washington and say, okay, enough. We want you to start acting like you're a Congress, solving the problems, which, by the way, most of the problems the government can't solve. So what we want you to do to solve the problem is get the heck out of the way so that we can solve the problem for ourselves. Most of those problems are solved at the local level, not in Washington, D.C.
Right. And I have friends that have said, well, gosh, you know, whatever the government does really doesn't affect my life whatsoever. And, you know, they just do what, you know, go on with their lives, with their occupations, their family, and whatnot, and really just don't pay any attention to what the government is doing. But I think that's erroneous, an erroneous attitude, because we do have laws that are imposed upon us. Well, for instance, the income tax law. It doesn't matter it's not a legal law. It shouldn't have been passed. And so it does affect everyone. And if, you know, try not paying it. You get arrested, you get your, things are confiscated, your assets are confiscated. So we do have to accept responsibility for doing something about what we oppose. And the government does a lot of things to us, whether we like it or not.
I think those people, if those same people that you've talked to were talking to me, I think I would stop them immediately in their tracks and say, okay, wait a minute. You're telling me that none of the laws affect your individual lives. And if they said, well, that's right. Yeah, exactly. I'd say, okay, how about the law that takes the money out of your pocket and dispenses it to charities that the federal government likes to support?
Exactly.
Maybe that does affect me. Well, how about the laws that tell you that you'll be safer if you wear a helmet when you ride a bicycle or when you put a strap on yourself in an automobile?
Right.
Well, but those really save lives. Okay, maybe they do, but they also establish a precedent so that the next thing the court tells you is that you can't turn the radio on or that you can't do something else while you're in your car driving. Is that going to be okay with you? Well, no, I don't think I'd let them go that far. Well, how are you going to stop them when you already have let them go as far as you have? I mean, people have to start thinking beyond the end of their nose.
Right. For instance, go ahead.
What really bothers me is the fact that civics is not taught in school anymore, and that people don't understand the structure of the government. I read a letter to the editor in our paper this morning that was critical of the fact that the election was affected by the structure of what we have in terms of the electors and the Electoral College.
Right.
And it's so interesting because a few days before, there was this map of the United States showing how if we didn't have an Electoral College, there were about four states that would have determined the election. And so I thought to myself, I wonder if that person who wrote the letter to the editor saw that, and if he wondered about how his vote would be totally ineffective coming from a smaller state of the state of Washington than the state of California, for example. And so what difference would his vote make? That's what the Electoral College was for, because the states were forming the Constitution and the United States, and they were concerned about statehood. That's where they lived. And I wanted to write him a letter that said, "Dear sir, maybe you don't understand this, but you are first a citizen of the state of Washington and then a citizen of the United States only because the states became united."
Right.
Would you please study your history?
The other thing, too, is the popular election of senators. They used to be... there was a difference.
They were appointed by the state legislature.
State, right.
And there was a purpose for that. Sure.
Right.
And by the way, those people who want to do away with the Electoral College by pointing out that Mrs. Clinton got the vote of the majority of the popular vote apparently have forgotten the difference between a democracy and a republic.
Right.
Because the very definition of democracy is a rule by the people,
right,
which can result in mob rule, and often does.
Right, instead of ruled by the law, yeah.
Yeah, and a republic is a rule by the people who are elected as representatives. And that brings about a more stable rule than the rule by the public as a whole, which is the reason for the difference.
Right.
You know, people need to be reminded of these things. I think what's interesting is, and maybe you thought this, or maybe some of the people who buy the book will think this, they think, you know, I'm having difficulty reading some of the things that were said by our founders when they were trying to convince people to accept the Constitution as drafted. And a friend of mine told me that.
Huh. We are going to...
Need to go to a break.
Right. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. All righty. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest this first hour has been Donald C. Brockett. He is the author of The Tyrannical Rule of the U.S. Supreme Court, How the Court Has Violated the Constitution. It is available at Amazon and also at his website, which is criticalbookspublications.com. Alrighty, we're talking about... we're talking about a lot of things, but certainly what we can do about what is going on. I know that I have written many, many, many letters to Congress, and I don't know that just to individuals. And I've received responses. And basically what I've been told was, well, you know, I'm going to vote the way that I want. And... which seems like, gosh, well, aren't you supposed to be representing the public? I mean, they have a lot of lobbyists who are representing the corporations, and the the citizens don't have the money to hire a lobbyist to go in and pay the representatives to represent the citizens.
No, they pay the representatives to represent us, and you think that's what they're supposed to be doing, but I agree with you. I've tried the same thing. For example, when you go online and you try to find an email list for the representatives or the senators, what you find immediately is that you have to go to their individual website, and when you want to send a message, you have to send it to each individual one.
Right.
Instead of being able to add a number of different names on one email and send it to all of them, for example, about a particular bill that's being voted upon. But the one that really took me aback was the time I wrote to Senator Rockefeller, I believe it was, who represented Virginia at the time, and I got a letter back saying, I'm sorry, but I'm not really interested in what you have to say because you're not a constituent of mine, because I lived in Washington State instead of Virginia. So I wrote back and I indicated that I thought he should never again refer to himself as a United States Senator. He wasn't going to represent the United States. He could call himself the Senator from Virginia, but nothing other than that.
Wow.
And I'm afraid that's the problem, is that the people within the jurisdictions have to bring to bear their feelings to their individual representatives and senators in order to be affected. Because the people get back to Washington, D.C., and they just forget the individuals at home.
Sure, and they usually come back quite wealthy, and it certainly wasn't from their regular check that they get for being a representative.
Yeah.
So that
how would you get them to vote for a law that affected them? I mean, most people don't realize that none of the laws that they impose on the rest of the country affect them because they exempt themselves from them.
Sure, like that they're almost permanents in Washington and the health care and all the other stuff. Well, thank you very much for being on the program. It's been delightful.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll be right back. Thank you. Bye-bye.